Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
Hope you had a great Mother's Day, America. It is time for A Nation. I'm Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for watching. We've got a great show. Three guests I want you to see right away. Ben Shapiro, what happened to the institutions in America? How to get them back on track and believe in it again. And Ambassador Jamison Greer, playing wide left. He's talking about trade deals. He's bringing in a lot of deals. How is it going to affect you and your household? He will tell us that. Also, Rare Earth, the quest to beat China to it. And Sage Steele. Sage looks at what's happening in Los Angeles and tells you why it should matter to you and your home, and possibly every city in America. But first, the fastest, most impactful monologue in America. Tonight, a growing exodus from America's bluest states. And it's not just regular families packing up because of taxes or safer streets. It's some of the biggest job creators in the country. The latest, billionaire investor Citadel boss Ken Griffin. He is doubling down on his move to Miami from New York. Why? Because in many blue cities, success isn't celebrated anymore. In fact, it is targeted. It is vilified. And socialist style politics may get cheers on TikTok with your socialist mayor right here in New York, but they can come with a multi-billion dollar price tag.
When I ran for mayor, I said I was going to tax the rich. Well, today, we're taxing the rich. I'm thrilled to announce we've secured a pied-à-terre tax, the first in New York's history. This is an annual fee on luxury properties worth more than $5 million, whose owners do not live full-time in the city. Like for this penthouse, which hedge fund CEO Ken Griffin bought for $238 million.
Guy thinks it's a good move. Griffin is not alone in his outrage. Other billionaires said, I've seen enough. Travis Kalanick, Joe Lonsdale has been on our show before. Both went from California to Texas. Larry Ellison left California, went over to Nashville. Jeff Bezos from Seattle to Florida because of the socialist mayor. And guess what? She doesn't care.
I think the claims that millionaires are going to leave our state are like super overblown. And if, you know, the ones that leave, like, bye.
Okay, that's what they said. Goodbye. New York Post reporting Wall Street giant Apollo aims to open a second headquarters outside of New York City. The latest fallout from Mamdani's war on the wealthy. Blue states have bled $2 trillion in wealth to red states over the last 10 years. New York leads the pack. The Big Apple is already staring down a massive budget deficit. I think it's $5.4 billion. And now they are openly vilifying the very people writing the huge tax checks, funding charities, investing hundreds of millions of dollars into the city. Ken Griffin alone has given more than $2.5 billion to charity in the Big Apple. His company's a $6 billion investment in office redevelopment is now on the docket. It's connected to 6,000 construction jobs, about 15,000 permanent roles, too. They are at stake. Those people rent apartments. They go out to dinner. They help the economy. They might even need to shop and buy clothes. New York has benefited enormously from his success. Do you get it? They don't get it. The mayor is painting him as the bad guy, not for a crime, not for corruption, but for owning a $230 million penthouse and making money. Not only is Mamdani making people like Griffin feel underappreciated and unwelcome, he's also jeopardizing security.
The CEO of UnitedHealthcare was killed just a few blocks from my house. And anything that creates like an agitation in the extremist on either side of the aisle is a frightening dynamic.
It really is. That's the climate some business leaders say is being created, where wealth just isn't criticized, it is demonized. And here's the bigger issue. When these high earners leave, they don't just take their money. They take jobs, they take investment, they take philanthropy and tax revenue with them. This New York Post headline really spells it out. New York, California, and other high-tax states losing billions while Florida prospers from mass migration. One exodus was caused by a virus, the coronavirus. This one, by economic ignorance. Even after watching people and businesses flee, some of the left still do not get it. They keep pushing some socialist policies. They're proud socialists, then act shocked when the tax base disappears. Ladies and gentlemen, if you punish success long enough, who is left to pay your bills?
I consider the phrase tax the rich, quote, tax the rich, when spit out with anger and contempt by politicians both here and across the country, to be just as hateful as some disgusting racial slurs.
It was creepy and weird.
Agreed.
I mean, like, knock, knock, knock on the window. You literally look at the first time, and you're like, you got to be kidding me. Okay? And then the second time, you're like, you know what? This is actually, this has gone from creepy to actually not really creepy. This has gone to frightening.
It's anti-American, too. Joining us now, a man who has seen the business booming in his home state of Florida. He wants to be governor there. And he was working in banking, finance, insurance industries before becoming a congressman. You know him well, Congressman Byron Donalds, who wants to be the governor of Florida. Congressman, as I was going through all this, do you think the socialists don't understand that when you vilify rich people, they leave with the money to finance social programs?
First, I think they're just economically illiterate. I'm not even sure if they really understand what they're doing. But the broader thing is that when you go after and attack success and you attack wealth, it leaves. It happens every single time. It's actually not just a phenomenon in today's America. It's a phenomenon of world history. And so I think these democratic socialists that are unfortunately running New York City, Washington State, California, and Chicago, they think that their political rhetoric is going to lead to better times. It never, ever does. You have to have sound, common sense, conservative economic policy. That's how this works. You have to protect property rights. You have to protect people's ability to build wealth and retain wealth. And yes, you can't overtax them, because if you kill the golden goose, especially with very wealthy people, they'll just leave and you'll be left holding the bag. So Mamdani is an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. It might look good on social media, but the city of New York is going to suffer greatly because of his idiocy, his immaturity, and his lack of economic common sense.
You talk about economic illiteracy. You want another example? I know you do. It's AOC who wants to run for senator or president. Watch.
There's a certain level of wealth and accumulation that is unearned, right? You can't earn $1 billion.
That's right.
You just can't earn that.
That's exactly correct.
You can get market power. You can break rules. You can do all sorts of things. You can abuse labor laws.
Yep.
You can pay people less than what they're worth.
Yep.
But you can't earn that, right?
Right. I should tell Jerry Seinfeld, Taylor Swift, Michael Jordan, Oprah, they're cheaters. They didn't pay their people enough, and they're fake billionaires. How do you explain that philosophy?
You can't explain that philosophy. It's stupidity. It makes no sense. Look, if she ran for president, she would lose. Because what you're trying to say is that she knows more than over 2,000 years of experience with free markets and voluntary exchange. Because that's what our economic system is. It's a system of voluntary exchange where people make decisions every single day with their resources in exchange for other goods and services. Let's take a Jeff Bezos. Do we agree politically all the time? No, probably not. But the truth is, millions of Americans, millions upon millions of people go through the Amazon marketplace and they buy products. And as a result, because of using his service, he's become very, very wealthy. I don't begrudge him for that. He's earned that because people have chosen through voluntary means to do business with his company. What is AOC going to do? She's never run any company. So how does she even know how to actually generate wealth? She doesn't. She likes to pontificate. She likes to run her mouth. She likes to talk about things that she has has no real-world experience in actually doing. And so, yeah, if she ran for president, she would go down in a blaze of glory because she would lose very badly because you cannot turn off the economic engine that has made the United States the envy of the world. If you do that, the very people that you say you care about, they're the ones who suffer the most when you can't pay police officers, when you can't take care of basic sanitation, and you have an economy flat on its back where people cannot get jobs, cannot earn money, and build wealth for themselves.
So look, I know you're going to be leaving the House, and odds are you're going to be the next governor of one of the most prosperous states in the country. But this redistricting arms race is really going the Republicans' direction. First, you got Virginia overturned, and then the Louisiana decision that decides that you can no longer gerrymander on the basis of race, which has caused Louisiana, Alabama, Tennessee, and other states to consider redistricting. You Republicans could be gaining 14 to 18 seats. First off, on the issue of race, do you believe it's a step backwards on the issue of race? And it's an example of Jim Crow that the Supreme Court made that decision in Louisiana.
No, the Supreme Court did the absolute right thing. Racial gerrymandering should not be allowed in the United States of America. There was a time when the 1965 Voting Rights Act was passed where black Americans were systematically discriminated against by Democrats in the South of the United States of America. That's a fact. That's what happened. And so you needed the 65 Voting Rights Act because of the systematic discrimination against black Americans. But if you look at the last 30 years in America, there is no systematic discrimination. The court looked at that, looked at all the evidence, looked at all the information, and they ruled correctly that you do not need racial gerrymandering today. They did the exact right thing. And so now what you're going to see is gerrymandering and redistricting along the lines that the court said is allowable around representation of people within their communities. And yes, in some respects, it could be political depending on the state that you are, or that you are in. But let's be very clear. Racial gerrymandering is illegal. It should be illegal. We shouldn't set congressional boundaries based on race. We shouldn't be setting anything in our country today based on race. It should be set based upon merit. It should be based on ideas and innovation.
Right. Congressman, I'm happy for you. You're running for governor, but you are going to be missed in the House. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Midterms just 6 months away, and the battle for Congress may come down to one issue, the economy. With Americans still worried about prices, jobs, economic uncertainty in some cases, the White House is betting big that the president's aggressive trade strategy can reshape the midterm conversation. The administration says historic trade deals now being negotiated around the world will bring manufacturing back home, strengthening supply chains, reducing America's dependence on China. Here to break it down for us, the United States Trade Ambassador. We're privileged to have with him. He's quite a busy guy, Ambassador Jamison Greer. Ambassador, I see the deals. I'm looking at the number of deals that you have cut with various countries. And a lot of people say, good job. But when will I feel the benefit of that? What do you say to them?
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be on. And this is a great question. So we spent the past year obviously using tariffs to protect American production, and that gets a lot of the news. But a little bit of the untold story are these deals. We've had dozens of countries come to us and pledge to lower their tariffs and non-tariff barriers to U.S. exports. And a lot of them have already done that, dropping those tariffs. Just a couple of examples. United States exports of corn went up by 25% last year, right? That's a huge amount. And if you look at January, February, and March of this year, U.S. exports were over $300 billion in each month. Those are the highest figures in 250 years of American history, each month beating the record of the previous one. This doesn't happen organically. This is something that comes from all the deals that President Trump has been striking. So we're seeing the Americans who build stuff, who grow stuff, who make stuff, they're not only serving the American market now, they're getting more overseas, and that means more jobs here.
And you just said you came in here and saw a balance. We weren't building anything anymore. We weren't making anything anymore. And it jeopardized our security. The pandemic kind of alarmed me to that. When did you realize this was a problem?
Well, listen, if you go back to President Trump's first term, We knew this at the time. We'd had folks in America predicting this. Ross Perot's famous sucking sound of NAFTA with jobs going down to Mexico, that actually happened. We lost a lot of that. So in the first term, President Trump, he started putting tariffs on China to protect our industry, protect our auto industry. A lot of countries in the world right now are getting flooded with Chinese vehicles, but the American economy is not. Instead, what we have are production lines moving back from Mexico, back from Canada to the United States. Stellantis, who makes Jeep and Dodge, they have a $13 billion investment in the U.S. Toyota, who makes in America, a $10 billion investment. So we are seeing these critical supply chains, these critical industries that bring an ecosystem of manufacturing with them, they're all coming back.
The first trade deal I remember really trying to sink into was the NAFTA. And President Trump, when he was a businessman, said, this is a terrible deal. And that's what you're talking about, the sucking sound. So you redid it with the USMCA, what your predecessor did, Lighthizer. And now you're trying to update it, which you're supposed to. But you're having a huge problem with Canada. What's the problem with Canada?
Well, there are a few things. First of all, when President Trump initiated his trade program last year, where he had a global tariff, irrespective of the country, we're trying to get our trade deficit under control. Most countries understood what we were trying to do. They didn't love having a tariff placed on them, but they understood. But two countries in the world retaliated against us for that. One was the People's Republic of China, which you kind of expect, and the other was Canada, which you wouldn't expect. And then on top of that, they started doing things like taking alcohol, American alcohol, off the shelves. They have some longstanding barriers. They don't have a lot of free access for American dairy into Canada. And our entire northern tier of states, whether it's a red state or a blue state, they have dairy farms, and they want to be able to sell more freely into Canada. So a variety of things like that with Canada they haven't fixed. They have the retaliation on top of that. So those are just a handful of the issues we're facing with our neighbors to the north.
So is there a chance the USMCA is not going to work?
The way to think about this is we have a review coming up that's required by U.S. statute and by the agreement on July 1st. And what that means is that each party to the agreement, each country, has an opportunity to say, you know what, we'll just renew this, we'll rubber stamp it, or we'll go on the path to exiting the agreement over a period of years. But during that time, we'll try to negotiate resolutions to the issues we see in the agreement. And I would say that I don't think President Trump is inclined to just rubber stamp this. USMCA has a lot of stuff in it that's important for the economy, some load-bearing pillars. But we expected to see a lot more production reshored to the United States, and there wasn't enough. So clearly there are things there that need to be fixed. So I think we're going to be in a mode of trying to improve that and have new deals with Canada and Mexico.
Mm. Ambassador, I think when they write the story of Trump 2, they're going to write you were one of the MVPs. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. Next on this show, trust in American institution is fading, but there is a way back. And Ben Shapiro is here to tell us how. And still to come on this show, Republicans are making headway in Dem strongholds. We'll tell you where with Sage Steele. And be sure to catch me on tour on stage. Streamed on Fox Nation, Reno, Nevada, in a couple of weeks, May 30th. Pensacola, Florida, July 11th. And new dates for Uniting the States. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. I'm talking about Westbury, Long Island, Redback, New Jersey, Clearwater, Florida, and Jacksonville, and then just outside St. Louis, November 21st. Don't move. 5 minutes out of downtown. Ain't nothing but a countdown. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three shots of whiskey.
Trust in our institutions in the United States is at an all-time low that is across the board. Trust in the media is at an all-time low. Trust in church is at an all-time low. Trust in the scientific establishment is at an all-time low. Trust in government is at an all-time low. And, of course, trust in academia is at an all-time low. And because of our lack of trust in institutions, Americans also mistrust one another.
So where do we go from here? That growing distrust is now showing up everywhere in American life that Ben talked about. A new USA Today report highlighting collapsing confidence in colleges and universities as more Americans question whether campuses are educating students or pushing ideology. A Yale committee, yep, Yale did this study, found three major factors driving the decline in trust in higher education. Soaring costs, of course, concern over who gets in, and growing fears over free speech, political bias, self-censorship on campus. So that same committee issued more than 20 recommendations to rebuild trust, including protecting free speech, supporting academic freedom, making colleges more affordable, and reforming admissions. So can America restore trust in its institutions and each other? Let's ask Ben Shapiro. You just saw him giving that speech at the University of Austin, host of the Ben Shapiro Show. So, Ben, how concerned are you about the distrust in institutions? Enough to give a speech, but are you concerned it's ripping the foundation of the country?
I think that's the main concern right now. And when you look to why Americans really dislike each other and mistrust one another, I think that the thing to keep in mind is that the places where we learn to trust one another are within institutions. The institution of the family, those are the people you trust most. When you go to church, those are people that you trust at a very high level because you are similarly oriented toward the world. When you go to work, that's an institution that helps shape how you live. So maybe you trust your coworkers. If you're at a university, same kind of thing. But the key with any institution is that it has to be directed at a particular goal. And that means that all the people who are within that institution are shaped in that direction. Well, when institutions lose their root cause, when they sort of go off in different directions, when they decide that the real cause of the institution for academia is no longer education, but indoctrination or social engineering, when people decide that the institution of science is no longer about evidence or truth, it's about political engineering. When people decide to move away the institutions from their reason for being, then mistrust goes up. And then the institutions can't actually bring us together. They instead end up dividing us, and it ends up in a sort of hand-to-hand combat over who controls institutions of power rather than us all joining the institutions to work together toward a common cause.
Right. So, you know, you see colleges trying to reform themselves and President Trump putting incredible pressure on them. So I'm somewhat optimistic, at least for two more years. But I just jotted this down in listening to your speech the other day. Things that we don't believe anymore. I believe 9/11 was an inside job. That used to be a fringe speech. Now a lot of people that I know are coming up to me asking me, did we really land on the moon? Butler's, was that staged? And what about the White House Correspondents' Dinner? People are asking me, was that staged? Staged? Are you kidding me? And what about, we have all these things, all these other things going on with Israel being behind the assassination of Charlie Kirk or Erica. So is that a lot of what you're talking about?
Yes, because the fact is that when we go to find the truth, we tend to have to use what we call heuristic shortcuts. We find people we believe are trustworthy, and then we trust them, or institutions that we believe are trustworthy. Well, when the media blows out its trust, when it turns out that people stop being able to believe that the media are telling them the truth, then they are able to go find somebody who tells them what they want to hear. And if that person tends toward conspiracism, if that person has no internal commitment toward the truth, people will follow them right down that path. So if you ask people why they believe, for example, that the moon landing was fake, typically they will cite some source that told them that the moon landing was fake. It's not that they went and actually looked at all the tapes. It's not that they actually went down the rabbit hole and investigated all the science, because then they would learn that the moon landing actually happened. Instead, they found somebody that they quote unquote trust, and that person told them that the moon landing was fake, and they use that as the basis for all of their subsequent investigations. And so the only way to restore trust to institutions is to, again, demonstrate over and over and over that what you are saying is true and backed by evidence. Right. But my fear is that we now live in an informational environment in which the dopamine rush, the sort of sugar rush of finding people who you like and who are interesting, who say crazy things that jog your limbic system, that's a very high bar to overcome for the reinstitution of truth.
Oh, just keep hammering away, and hopefully people understand where the truth is. Meanwhile, where opinion is and where the truth is. Meanwhile, speaking of opinion, it was my opinion that Barack Obama always fancied himself a moderate. And if you still think he's a moderate years after being out of office, forget it. The guy he is praising and getting behind and hailing is Mayor Mamdani, this disastrous mayor right here where I am in New York City. Listen to this.
I'm not as worried about this so-called rift between the left and liberals. You look at somebody like Mamdani, who I think is an extraordinary talent. He wants people to be able to afford housing in New York. Well, you know, I would assume liberals in New York want the same thing. What I'm more interested in for Democrats is, do you know how to just talk to regular people like we're not in a college seminar?
Yeah, or talk to him like you're in Cuba or Russia. He is a socialist. Billionaires should be banned. We should be telling landlords, stop charging people rent. Let's have free food. Let's have free buses. Why do you think that he's getting behind a 34-year-old inexperienced mayor who is way over his head?
I think the reason is because the dirty little secret about Barack Obama is, was, and will forever be that he is just as radical as Zoran Mamdani. He's just a better liar. Barack Obama was Zoran Mamdani. They have very similar life stories and similar life experiences. They have very similar belief systems. Barack Obama masqueraded as a moderate. And people tend to forget what he actually did as president because it's been a while. But the reality is that Donald Trump was a direct reaction to the radicalism of Barack Obama, a man who used the federal government to force boys into the girls' bathroom, who used the IRS to target his political opposition, who sold out American foreign policy to Russia, China, and Iran. I mean, this president of the United States came in as a racial unifier. By the time he left office, America's racial numbers were worse than before he came in by leaps and bounds. And so the idea that Obama represents sort of the old liberal wing versus the new far left wing, I think it's just a lie. I think he actually loves everything that Zoran Mamdani is doing. He has much more sympathy toward Mamdani's positions than he does toward the positions of, say, a John Fetterman or a Jake Auchincloss or some of the so-called moderates inside the Democratic Party.
So, Ben, you're probably not going to go to the library this weekend. I'm pretty sure of that he's just opening up. Lastly, who do you think's the standard bearer after Trump? Do you believe everyone should get out of the way for Vice President J.D. Vance? Do you think that will happen? Do you think it should happen?
I don't think that it will happen. I don't think it should happen. I think that there is a very rich debate about the direction of the Republican Party on everything from foreign policy to economics to social policy going forward. And I think that obviously the president's touting of somebody is going to be a heavy factor in who Republicans decide to mobilize behind. But if you are looking at, for example, the Cauchy odds right now, Marco Rubio is climbing. There's a reason for that. He's incredibly competent. There's some governors out there who are incredibly competent. So, I don't think that it's a clear field for the vice president. Again, I think he has the advantage going in, but things change and we'll see who the president decides to get behind.
Ben Shapiro, always great to hear your point of view. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Meanwhile, don't move. Next on One Nation, Sage Steele next. And please check out my YouTube page. Everybody's talking about it, even more than the Trump watches. YouTube.com at the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Welcome to Fox News Live. I'm Marianne Rafferty in Los Angeles. The body of an American soldier who went missing while in Morocco for military drills has been found. First Lieutenant Lamont Key Jr. and another soldier disappeared about a week ago. A preliminary report says the two were part of a group who went on a hike to watch a sunset. One reportedly couldn't swim, and the second soldier and others attempted a rescue. The Army says search operations for the other service member will continue. That soldier has not been identified. And Brent crude prices jumping up 3% to $104 a barrel, while U.S. crude climbed to about $98 a barrel today. Stalling peace talks between the U.S. and Iran are raising major concerns about when oil will pass through the Strait of Hormuz. The key waterway is critical for about one-fifth of the world's oil. Average gas prices in the U.S. are now up to $4.52. I'm Marianne Rafferty. Now back to One Nation.
The reality is, no matter how many beds you give these people, they are on super meth. They are on fentanyl. The Councilwoman Robbins' plan for treatment first, I will go below the Harbor Freeway tomorrow with her, and we can find some of these people she's going to offer treatment for. She's going to get stabbed in the neck. These people do not want a bed. They want fentanyl or super meth.
This is a MAGA Republican's idea of what Los Angeles looks like. This is really not.
Both of these people have been the reason why there's no more Hollywood. You know, I talk to producers. They have to pay gang members right now to keep the streets safe, to go film anything on the streets of L.A.
He was awesome. Spencer Pratt overwhelmingly winning the Los Angeles mayoral debate this week, following a trend of Republicans gaining ground in Democratic-run cities and states. The California governor race, not only closer than people expected, but a Republican outsider, Steve Hilton, good friend of the show, is actually leading in the polls. And in other places like New York, Governor Kathy Hochul seeing massive competition. Republican Bruce Blakeman went from 16 to 9 points. Are people fed up? Are Democrats fed up enough to vote for a Republican? Let's ask the host of the Sage Steele Show, Sage Steele. Sage, it was my opinion that that mayoral race was more than about Los Angeles. I think it was a bigger debate about the fundamental issues. And instead of talking at each other, they were shoulder to shoulder. Am I wrong on that?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And it was incredible to see Spencer Pratt, a reality star who we've been watching online over the last several months, but go right there head to head. And he wasn't trying to crush them, but he inadvertently did by just speaking the truth and saying the things that I know and you know and everybody else knows Californians need to hear. People in Los Angeles need to hear because they're done. They're tired of stepping over bodies, literally. The homelessness problem is such a massive issue. And I love how honest and real he has been about the effect that the Palisades fire has had on him. And so many of his neighbors and friends and everybody throughout the Los Angeles area, because they knew it was potentially coming. It does every year. And what did they do? They actually made it easier for these fires to happen and take place. So I love what Spencer Pratt's doing. I also love what Chad Bianco and Steve Hilton are doing in that governor's race. Incredible. Californians, they talk about affordability first and foremost. We know it's the most expensive state with the highest taxes in the union, as well as the crime problem, the most crime per capita in the state of California. If this isn't the time to elect a Republican and bring on some change, then I don't know what it's going to take in California. To me, it's now or never.
A couple of things. What needs to happen is Democrats have to say, I'm just going to vote for a Republican. And because that doesn't happen, Republicans have been discouraged from running. I mean, we didn't get a real Republican in New York City. That real Republican doesn't run in Chicago. They say it's not worth the money. I think every Republican's got to try. They got to give people an alternative. And I just remember all my stuff burned in 1993. I was in California. You know whose fault it wasn't? The fire department. They were there in minutes. They were all over the mountain. There was plenty of water. Choppers were dropping water that they picked up from the ocean. It was amazing to see. The same city can't put out any fire at all. And now they changed the report. When the after action report on Karen Bass was bad, she actually changed it. And the people of Los Angeles should deserve better than that.
They do. It's disgusting. It breaks my heart to see. I have friends out there as well who lost a home. Kennedy, one of your cohorts there at Fox News, she is still lost in that mess of trying to replace her home. Insurance companies have dropped hundreds of thousands of people. Here's the key. It's a habit in California to vote Democrat. How do you get them out of the habit where it's like, well, this is just what we do?
Now, when you talk about civility, don't look at Mark Hamill, the star of Star Wars. Deletes a photo, take a look, depicting President Trump deceased in a casket. And he thought, well, he posted a new image of the president half apologizing. Isn't this rhetoric part of the problem? I mean, is this why they're taking three shots and maybe more assassination attempts at the president? You would think that this guy is more mature than that.
You would think, but I think I lost hope in Mark Hamill a long time ago. Went from, you know, being a young girl in the 70s watching Star Wars at the movie theater in 1977 in love with Luke Skywalker to embarrassed for him and so disappointed in him. He is one of the many problems with the Democratic Party and the left in general, who they say one thing about, you know, bringing people together and not being divisive, and he has gone to another level. He tried to come out and apologize for his post afterwards.
Yeah, we
but
just
no,
posted it. Yeah.
Water under the bridge at this point. It's too late. But you look at him, you look at Kathy Griffin, you look at Jimmy Kimmel, all these people double down. After President Trump was almost killed in Butler nearly 2 years ago, for like a week, they all kind of got quiet and said, okay, let's temper this down. That's all it was. And ever since then, it's continued to get worse and worse and worse. What's the accountability? I don't know. I guess nothing, because we do love and appreciate the First Amendment. But from a business perspective, Disney, whoever it is that hires some of these people repeatedly, maybe that's where the accountability comes in. But it is heartbreaking to see. And this happened less than 2 weeks after what happened at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So I don't know what else we can do, as far as a government. Let them say it. But as consumers, you don't go see the movies, you don't go buy the products, whatever it is. We have to take a stand against people like Mark Hamill.
Well, I hope you had a great Mother's Day, Sage Steele. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes of your time. And now you can go back to your family. Sage Steele, thanks so much. And you have a fantastic podcast. Everybody should check it out. Meanwhile, straight ahead, circle back, Jen Psaki. She says there's no room where Dems decide the nominee. You know, that dark room, that back room, that smoke-filled room. But isn't that exactly what happened with Kamala Harris and what happened with Joe Biden? Brett Baer weighs in. Are the Dems in disarray? We'll talk about it when you come back to One Nation.
I can hear him singing, keep on dreaming. There is no, thank God, dark room in Washington where people sit around, they decide here's who the nominee is going to be.
Really? Former President Biden, press secretary, turned MS Now anchor Jen Psaki, telling her viewers there is no dark room where the Democratic nominee is decided. But isn't that exactly what happened in 2024 when the party replaced Joe Biden and installed Vice President Kamala Harris as the nominee? And may I remind you how Hillary Clinton sidelined Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden was basically handpicked by a congressman from South Carolina? Well, Harris, who is rumored to be considering another run, reportedly telling donors the DNC should release the buried autopsy of her failed campaign, which means she must know it doesn't make her look bad, which means it's got to be worthless. Joining us now is the author of a brand new book, bestseller, The Case for America, and anchor a special report. You might have guessed it by his shot of his torso. It is special report anchor Brett Baer. Brett, congratulations on your book, The Case for America. But before I do that, I want you to talk about the case for Kamala Harris. I'm looking at these polls. I know how early it is, but she's up 50 to 22 over Newsom, Josh Shapiro, AOC, Pritzker, all in single digits. She wants a coronation. Will she get it?
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me on. I don't think she's going to get it. I don't think that while this number here is about name recognition and who was up last, I think it's hard to believe that the Democratic Party is going to rally around Vice President Harris again. You're right to point out that, you know, there was a dark room that decided that there was not going to be a mini primary. Even President Obama was rumored to have said, let's have a little contest here after Joe Biden drops out after that debate. And go back to South Carolina in 2020 and how Joe Biden is essentially given the nomination after others step out in order to prevent Bernie Sanders from having positive primaries and caucuses along the way. It's tough to imagine that Kamala Harris is going to cruise to the nomination. I think there's going to be a cast of thousands by the time we get to the real nominating process on the Democratic side, but we'll see.
Yeah, I just want you to hear what she said. This is going to be a bit of her mission statement. Watch.
For far too many people in our country, the American dream is not real. And in fact, for many people in their lived experience, it's what they would consider an American myth.
Kind of inspirational, isn't it?
Well, this is exactly kind of what my book's about, is the case for America as opposed to talking down America. And when I set out to do it, it was voices from the past and presidents and present voices that are just saying, ahead of this America 250, let's take a moment, take a step back and say what we do right here in this country, and focusing on freedom and liberty. The American dream is still a reality, despite the fact what the vice president says. There are tough times. This is not a sanitized look. We're not looking through rose-colored glasses. There are problems. But it's still, as you travel the world, the best place in the world to be.
And you do travel the world, and that's what gave you that perspective. And it wasn't too long ago, and it could happen again, where I remember I was going to the White House, and they were trying to pull Andrew Jackson's statue down right in front of the White House. You remember what they've done, Ulysses S. Grant, and tried to take Lincoln off the side of a grammar school. And I'm wondering, Brett, is that what propelled you to do this? Let the who's who of America tell their story?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we should embrace our past, not erase it. There are scars and mistakes and problems that we've done in the past, but we've gotten through them. We've evolved. We are not perfect. You know, I talked to people like Condoleezza Rice, who was born in the segregated South in Birmingham, was friends with the girls who got killed in that bombing at the church, and studied, worked hard, and became Secretary of State and National Security Advisor in the Bush administration, said she looked in the mirror and said, only in America can this happen to this black girl from Birmingham. Her story, other stories, are really inspiring. So there's this website, thecaseforamerica.com, and I started it just to talk about the book and kind of promote it. But I decided that people should put their case for America on there in 30-second videos. I'll give the first 100, you know, that are good, signed book. That's what I thought would be a sales thing. Well, now dozens and dozens of people have done this, and I spent an hour last night looking at videos from around the country, every race, religion, ethnicity, political bent, and they're making their case for America, and it's pretty cool.
I want you to hear what Marco Rubio, so if there's a paperback, a lot of times they ask you to add a chapter. I believe Rubio should be a candidate. Listen to what he said the other day.
My hope for America is what it's always been. I think it's the hope I hope we all share. We want it to continue to be the place where anyone from anywhere can achieve anything, where you're not limited by the circumstances of your birth, by the color of your skin, by your ethnicity, but frankly, it's a place where you are able to overcome challenges and achieve your full potential.
And we know Marco's background. His dad had to escape from Cuba, had no money, was able to raise his family, and next thing you know, he's got one of his sons as a senator from Florida, and now he's Secretary of State.
I didn't even give him the book before that briefing. But it's essentially the book. That is essentially the book, and in a lot of different ways and shapes and forms. I think that common shared love is something that brings us together no matter your political bent. And the America 250 July, celebrating the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, could be that time, that feeling like when an athlete in the Olympics, an American athlete, wins the gold and the flag is going up and you get, you know, something in your throat and you get a little teary-eyed because the athlete is really into it as well. Like that feeling where we rally around sports is kind of maybe what could happen around July 4th and the 250th.
And I watched you with the hockey team after they won gold, too, and I know you felt the same way. The name of the book is A Case for America. It is really excellent. Brett, I read The Uncorrected Proof, and I was inspired when I was done. I don't know if you've changed the final copy, but I loved endorsing it, and thanks so much for asking me. Best of luck. I know it's going to open up number one.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Now it's time for your sneak peek of the week. Let's go. Wow, we've got a lot of House hearings this week. One I'm looking at, the defense budget. It's up to Congress to say you can spend $1.5 trillion. It's up to General Dan Kane and Secretary of War Pete Hegseth to tell us what he's going to do with it. We need it. Make sure you write that check. Secretary of Interior Doug Burgum will be testifying about his budget. He's got a lot of 250 stuff in that. Hopefully they'll greenlight that. And the Senate analyzing FAA safety measures to prevent future collisions. We're all a little concerned, especially after what happened in Newark. Horse racing, the Preakness Stakes is on Saturday. In sports, NHL and NBA playoffs continue. We all know how the NBA playoffs will end. The Knicks win the championship, first time since 73. That is it for us tonight. Happy Mother's Day to all the wonderful moms out there, including my beautiful wife, Dawn. And tune into my radio show on Monday, 9 to noon. Doug Schoen and Michael Goodwin will be with us. And don't forget, in a few hours, I'm going to jump in the shower, change outfits, and I'll be on Fox and Friends. I'll be to the left of Lawrence and Ainsley. Two things before we go. Always stay within yourself and keep it right here on Fox News.